Right back at you, Speak On It podcast.
What's up?
Try to get at you once a week. I am your host, Logic I'm In.
Waving Nose the Third.
Kameko Thomas.
Let's just jump right into it, man. Let's just get into this whole Vester Flanagan, Bryce Williams thing. Black man who claims that he was harassed in his 23-page manifesto for being gay and black. Goes into the network that he was fired from because they said that he was presenting like a hostile work environment, and goes after, from what I am hearing, the young lady who took his position or was put in his position after he was fired, goes in there with a body cam, okay, and shoots her and another one of the colleagues and then pulls the gun on himself. His 23-page manifesto talks about his admiration for the Virginia Tech shooter, saying he did it because unarmed black men are being killed, like in North Carolina. He mentioned Dylan Roof, and it's basically an eye for an eye, giving white people a taste of their own medicine. And since then, there have been many black people who don't condone his actions, but they understand. They understand that the network was probably dismissive of his allegations and his complaints, and living a life where he felt like he was being oppressed by being black and gay, and that even though they don't agree with it, they understand why he did it. And this needs to be used as a marker that we just can't just casually dismiss the claims of people who are saying they are victims of homophobia and racism. So I got a whole bunch of places I want to go with this. And I'm going to go ahead and start by saying Vester Flanagan is not our Nat Turner. Point blank, he's not a hero. And he totally disqualified himself from the social justice conversation when he decided to take the lives of those people. That's just how I feel. Y'all can chime in. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Kameko. You got this one first.
He did make it personal. And on that end, you know, unlike Dylan Roof, who did not know any, supposedly, if you believe the news reports, who supposedly did not go in there with the specific intent of targeting Senator Pinckney and just shot the other eight people to cover it up, Dylan Roof didn't know any of those people. You know, there was no personal reason for him to go out of his way to go to that church and shoot those people. Vester Flanagan, these were two people that he knew. He said that the young lady had made some comments to him that apparently she wasn't reprimanded for, and that the cameraman had reported him to HR after only working with him for one day. Now, I don't know if that happened. But I do know that even though he cited the South Carolina shootings as one of the things that ticked him off, it did seem more of an act of personal vengeance than it did an act of someone who was seriously trying to right a wrong. So yes, can we say that this was an act of social justice? Not necessarily. On the flip side, I also believe that this is someone who, as a, you know, a black male living in America's, you know, had his moment where he didn't feel that he was being heard and enough was enough. And so he did the only thing at that point he felt that he could do. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's condoning or condemning his behavior for me so much as it is understanding the mindset that drove his actions.
And I'm going to take a broader view and say, you know, this tragedy highlights the failure of the African diaspora here in this country to establish their own. I'm not going to sit here and say that you will not experience a dismissive white attitude, or that you won't experience institutionalized racism in America if you have your own institutions, but you'll have a lower frequency of these cases. If you have your own media outlets, if you have your own businesses, if you have your own schools, you don't have to rely on others. And again, the schizophrenia that we have to demonstrate on a daily basis in our professional settings you know, in my mind, speaks towards this. Speaks towards having to act one way at work, act one way at home. And then when the injustice comes and you're unable to deal with it effectively, you have cases like this. And then you top the injustices that we deal every day. You hear in the news about another brother killed. In the last 3 years, we've had a lot of young black men being killed by police, by racist whites. Some high profile, others not so much, but it's happening.
And I agree with everything you said. And I'll take a page out of Kameko's playbook and say this makes it harder.
Absolutely.
This makes us even more of a target. You know what I mean? And so when we get more and more Vester Flanagans and things of this nature who are acting, you know, violent towards, man, let's just go ahead and say it, white folks, man.
Okay. Just put it out
no,
there.
Seriously, black people can go throughout their neighborhoods and they can wreak havoc on people that look like them, and it's dismissive. It's like, mm-hmm. Oh man, that's what those, you know, those black people do.
No, let's say that's what those niggas do.
But when you start killing white people, mm-hmm. when you start killing unarmed white people, when you start killing innocent white people, that makes it so that you are making it very, very hard for every single other black person. And that's why I say this isn't an act of social justice. You, Vester Flanagan, Bryce Williams, you just now made it twice as hard for a brother to walk into a network and get a freaking job. You made it twice as hard.
With the climate being...
And it was already difficult. And I will say this too, just to piggyback on your comment, Wayman, about, you know, about black people having, you know, independent media outlets. Supposedly, that's why the NNPA was founded, the National Newspaper Publishers Association. I believe it was started by Robert Sengstack Abbott. I might be saying that totally wrong, but the who founded the Chicago mm-hmm. Defender. The point is, the NNPA was supposed to be, that was supposed to be our way of disseminating information and writing stories that specifically address what was going on in our community. And as someone who has written for an NNPA paper, I can say straight up that the concern that I've noticed seems to me still to be more about trying to make yourselves acceptable in the eyes of mainstream media. Absolutely. Instead of sticking to your mission of being that voice for the voiceless. So in that regard, yeah, we have, you know, television stations. We're not even going to get into that. But at least on the, at least in the printed medium front, we had something back in the day that stuck more to that mission. But as time progressed and Brown versus Board and all the integrationist things took place, then all of a sudden the concern became trying to find a way to fit in with the mainstream media establishment. So what is, what at this point, what would even be out there for a Bryce Williams of the world who felt like he had to change his name to Bryce Williams just so he could be an acceptable on-air personality, when there isn't really anything out there for us, because even our own so-called media outlets are not, they're not really out there for us. The Root, even though you think The Root is black owned, that is a subsidiary of the Washington Post. So even though it looks like we're out there writing new stories and creating our own narratives, for the most part, we're not, if you do the research.
Well, here, I'll piggyback on your other statement. I mean, whether you're changing your name, whether you're changing the way you speak, whether you're changing the way it is you walk, whether you're changing your mode of dress, your style of dress, either way, it still puts us in the position of having to conform to someone else's standard in order to be able to perform. And this is why I'm going to constantly say we have misinterpreted what enslavement really is. Because you can sit here and have all the creature comforts. You could have the Brooks Brothers suit. You could have the split level home. You can have the Italian shoes. You can have the Mercedes. You know, you can have all of these things. You can have the high five or low to mid six figure salary. You could be doing well. But as long as you're dependent on someone else for all of your basic needs, from the adhesive strip that holds your baby's diaper together to the institutions that educate our children, cut it any way you want to. You're a slave.
Yeah, and I think the best thing that black people in the media can do is disown his actions and pretty much disown him associated with his actions. You can't disown his actions and not disown him and say what he did was ungodly, was sinister. However, there is racism that exists, but this is not the way that you need to confront it.
And it's so unfortunate that we really are placed in the position of having to appear to completely dismiss this brother, completely disown him. Mm-hmm. Because we don't want to have to do that. We have this, we've always had this blind loyalty as a part of what unity and cohesiveness we've tried to build in our time in this country. But this is one of those times where we have to, you know, pull an Obama move. And, you know, I disavow
an Obama move.
What he did with Jeremiah Wright during the 2008 Democratic primaries.
Wow.
You know, yeah, it's sad. It's tragic.
I think when things like this happen, it tests, you know what I'm saying, white people's assessment of black people's response.
Absolutely.
It tests it because they're going to say, okay, we're going to see if black people just have this blind race allegiance to this man, you know what I'm saying, and are going to qualify his actions just for he's black. And I say, no. We qualify his, you know, his allegations and what he says, we'll qualify. They'll say, oh, yeah, I believe that in some kind of context that he was discriminated because of his color and his sexuality. Okay. However, how he handled it was totally wrong. That's number one. And there's so many hints that this is something bigger. This man was insane. Mm-hmm. He was mentally ill. First, like, you know, Kameko said
in the last episode, yes.
Yeah, like Kameko said, he made it personal. So what he did had nothing to do with the upliftment or progression, you know, in the terms of social justice when it comes to blacks in the mainstream media. It will not help us in any way. So that was personal. Number two, he took his own life. So he can't even say he's a proponent of Black Lives Matter because he took his own life. He took his own life. So that tells you that there was something deeper going on there. I could see himself killing these two white people. I know this sounds weird. Killing these two white people, staying alive, and then using every single opportunity throughout the media to be like, but look, this is what happened.
And this is why it happened.
Kind of like Christopher Mumford.
Okay. Well, here's what I want to ask. Kameko, you last episode...
Not to say that I condone Christopher Mumford, yeah, and I think that anything that he says has any kind of credence, by the way.
Disclaimer! But,
No, seriously.
No, absolutely. No, I'm being funny, but I'm laughing, but it ain't funny. But I just wanted to piggyback. Remember, last episode, you spoke about the emotional abuse that we've endured and how it has created some level of mental illness, collective mental illness amongst black people.
Yes.
So does this cater to that statement?
Absolutely. I 100% believe that because, again, what James Baldwin said, to be a Negro in America is to be in a constant state of rage. So you have to look at, even outside of Vester Flanagan's own personal experience, look at what you've been seeing in the media just within the last year. We're not even going to talk about the past 50 years. We're not going to talk about, you know, the 60th anniversary of Emmett Till's murder. So we're not even going to look at, we're not even going to go that far back. Let's just look at what has happened this year alone. So how can you, as a black man, or black woman too, or child, how can you, as a black person in America, see all these murders going on in the news and seeing that, you know, the murderers are going to investigate themselves and, of course, find themselves free from, you know, responsibility from any wrongdoing, and have that not have some sort of effect on you mentally? Now, in some people, it is enough to drive you absolutely mad and make you do whatever it is that you feel you need to do, because part of that, I would say, is just... that could have been a buildup of anger and pain and frustration that just hit a boiling point. And he snapped and just said, fuck it. Since I'm going any goddamn way, I'm going to at least take a couple motherfuckers that I can't stand with me.
I can't argue against that.
But the thing of it is, his actions also, though, for me, has made it a little bit difficult for us to be objective. Well, it's made it difficult for me to be objective, because when I wrote about that, I knew that, you know, it was really hard for me to say that I understood the motivations without saying that, you know, I mean, I did say this. I said, this is, you know, two white people being murdered in a sea of all of this black death, and people are going to be more concerned about those two Caucasians than they're going to be about all of these people, you know, whether or not they were criminals or whether or not they had drugs in their system. If you're saying that everyone has the right to a fair trial, in, you know, an impartial trial, jury bias, peers, and whatnot, then why are you always denying them their due process by shooting them in the back before, you know, before you even make it to the station to book them? So it is a symptom. It's symptomatic of what we as black people experience in this country. And I feel that his actions in that context make complete sense. But he's made it so hard for me to just say, I mean, hell, if I were you, I can't say that I wouldn't have done the same thing.
I want to also go with a larger issue. Logic, earlier you brought up the subject of blind racial or ethnic allegiance. I despise using the term race, but that's another discussion. But I want to ask, did we bring this on ourselves? Let's go back to, you know, the LA riots and how we justified brothers pulling that white dude out of the car. But there was a large contingent of African Americans who were like, now, eye for an eye. But
when it happened, you gotta understand, I was 17, 18 years old. So I didn't like it. I didn't like them.
I'm not saying you did.
No, what I'm saying is, let me explain.
Okay.
I didn't like it because it was just so grisly. It was just so nasty, man. They tried to beat the white off of him.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But then I heard that he was saying some racial slurs out the window, calling him nigger and stuff like that. I don't know how true that was. That kind of subsided a little bit, but I still thought that it wasn't, you know. And then I thought, when I was 18, I mean, it doesn't justify what happened to him, but it's kind of like, you know, running butt-ass naked with honey on you, you know, through a beehive. Like, why are you doing that, dude? Like, why would you be driving
in the middle of absolute chaos?
Maybe he didn't know or whatever. But anyway, but what were you getting on now?
Yeah, I was just saying, did we help create the scenario? Look at the aftermath of the O.J. Simpson trial. There was brothers and sisters out there celebrating, cabbage patching in the streets.
Yeah, that's insensitive.
I'm just asking, how much of this is our collective 40 plus million black people in America's fault?
What part is our fault? I'm still not understanding what you're talking about. What part?
I'm talking about the blind racial allegiance that some of us have displayed, and now we're in a position where, with everything, with all this recent death of black men within the last 3 years, we're having to watch ourselves. We're having to be careful. And how much of this was our creation?
I think there should be some kind of healthy, you know, race allegiance within, you know, within context. You know what I'm saying? We have to say, you know, we have to take that into consideration. You know, were you treated the way you were treated because of the color of your skin? Now, we should always take that in consideration. There should be some kind of allegiance that we have towards race.
That's what I'm saying.
But what we really should be critical about is our response. Mm. How did you respond, brother? How did you respond, sister? I get it. Yeah, I got your back. But the way you responded was not cool. It does not help us.
Mm.
You see what I'm saying?
We understand the hurt, but, you know, don't go ahead and create even more of a burner fire for us, you know, in a situation, in an era, in an environment that's becoming ever more hostile and anti-black.
Right. And part of the thing is I don't want Speak On It podcast to be that thing where we're airing dirty laundry, we're letting people all up in our black cave. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? And I don't want that to be like, oh man, because we know the conversations we have in front of white folks is different than the conversations we have in barbershops, mm-hmm. beauty salons, absolutely. Church,
amongst
and
ourselves.
In the basement when we make do speak on it.
Exactly.
When we're in that confine, we're not whispering no more. Even though I hate when black people do that, we start whispering in front of white folks. Just let's talk. But we really telling ourselves and be like, you know what, man, that ain't cool. You know what I'm saying? We'd be like, that's not cool. We should not be doing that. You feel me? We start having those really, really critical conversations and holding ourselves accountable. But we know we cannot afford to do that in mixed company because it will be used out of context.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There is, you know, and the thing, okay. And the thing of it is, too, when you are a perceived, educated, and articulate African-American and you are in that mixed company, there is this expectation that your thoughts are more in alignment with the Ben Carsons and Herman Cains of the world, that you cannot possibly have a more balanced and objective perspective on anything. That, you know, again, just to get back, when, you know, I wrote about this on my website, it was really hard to be objective while at the same time get to the heart of what I think drove Flanagan's actions. That was really difficult because on the one hand, I wasn't trying to necessarily condone what he did. On the other hand, I didn't want to totally dismiss why he did it in the first place. And that is a really difficult thing to do. Mm-hmm.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he made that next to impossible. So imagine. And I'm able to articulate those thoughts. Now imagine someone who can't, being in the same situation, it's not going to go down like
Man,
that.
Man, are we really to believe that dude can't articulate himself like that? I mean, I really feel like he had that capacity to do that. And I'm going to take this a little step further. And some people might have a problem with me saying what I'm about to say, but I'm about to go there.
Okay.
First of all, dude was highly educated, number one, okay? College degrees. He was taught by the best white people in the best institutions. Mm. Go look it up. Mm. Number two. So he knows how to deal with white folks. Number two, he already won a settlement.
He
knows how to do it. Number three, when we start talking about a brother who is gay, we cannot just toss it out that this was not an act of displaced anger. You can't disqualify that. It's not, you can say whatever you want to say about what I just now said. I'm not attacking him because he's gay, but we know that happens. Mm-hmm. That happens all the time. I see it all the time with my students. Students who are angry and brothers who are dealing with their sexuality, who know they can't come out. Mm-hmm. These brothers are some of the most violent, some of the most angry young men when all they need to do is just say, man, you know what, man, I'm gay. You know what I'm saying?
We don't create an outlet within our own communities for these brothers. We don't protect them.
That is a great point, Wayne.
We don't protect them.
Speak on that, because I know where you're going with that.
The bottom line is this. I remember seeing, what was that movie? Get on the Bus. And who was that? I know it was Isaiah Washington and another actor.
I know.
You talking about the light-skinned dude who's always in Spike Lee's movies?
Harry Lennox. Harry Lennox.
Yeah, he plays a Puerto Rican movie.
He plays an Arab, the next.
Exactly.
He's versatile. But it gave me the first, because I grew up, I'm not even going to front, I grew up being extremely homophobic, okay? Wasn't that what you did? Well, see, no, why are you doing this? Go on, just throw me under the
bus.
We're
going to have to get into the etymology of some of these words.
Yeah,
exactly.
Go ahead. But the bottom line is, I saw two actors displaying a couple that I could respect. I believe Harry Lennox's character quoted, "When I walked down the street, white women clutched their purses. They crossed the street just like they would for a brother who's straight. I'm going to the march because I'm a black man. My sexual preference doesn't change that fact." I almost stood up and clapped because I could respect that. But the bottom line is that we do not respect the brothers in our community who are gay.
And
we don't respect their manhood. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I would say that part of it too is there's a conflation of the, you know, the gay struggle for civil rights and the African American struggle for human rights.
Very true.
And I think a lot of the resentment that Black folks have toward the gay community is basically you piggybacked on our movement, but you haven't stepped back and said, well, now that we've gotten where we've gotten, let's reach back and help you, since you always want to talk about the solidarity. You know, you got yours, and then we're still in the position that we're in, and you're saying, well, you better figure out how to get yours the best way you can. And so we, in our, I think it is displaced anger. I don't necessarily think the issue for us is who's screwing who or why so much as it is you keep coming in and co-opting our movement and our struggle, and it always ends up halting our progress because it ends up becoming about you and where you're mm-hmm. trying to get to at our expense.
Elevating your progress.
And then once that happens, we're left, you know, trying to pick up where we left off.
That's it. Yeah. I'm sorry to cut you off, no, but no, that's real. You said it exactly how I was trying to say it. Your personal vendettas have nothing to do with our liberation. Vester Flanagan, that was a personal beef you had. You didn't come to any Black organizations. You didn't go to Black Lives Matter and say, how can I be of an help? How can I be an ally? How can I move your struggle? You said, no, I'm going to take this into my own hands and be selfish, and I'm going to shoot two people who look like passive participants of racism, okay? And then I'm going to shoot myself. You know what I'm saying? Like, that hadn't, you had no planning. You failed to plan, so you planned to fail. But I thought that you were going somewhere with it, too. We're also on the hook as the Black community because we have left these brothers behind. We have disrespected these type of people in our community. We've rejected them because they've aligned themselves with white institutions. They've aligned themselves with homosexuality, and we've discarded them. We have not embraced them. We have not loved them. So, it makes sense that one of our own that we have disowned will go kill some white folks and then make it harder for us on the street and make it harder for us when we're trying to engage and find employment in white institutions. It's all full circle.
And if he is as brilliant as you're saying that he is, then there's a distinct, we have to consider that he thought about that before he did it.
Exactly.
Which kind of disqualifies him as mentally insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that takes away that argument.
But you know what though? And I have to say this, man. We gotta stop, you know, doing this happy medium between people being insane and not. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Well, what was all the chips in place to make someone insane or not? Mm-hmm. Oh, he planned it out so he can't be insane. Man, I feel like, man, once you start taking other people's lives and once you start killing yourself, you're insane. But you know what? They never said the cop that killed Mike Brown, they never said, oh, he's insane. Hmm. Mm-mm. They never
said justifiable homicide.
They never said that the cop that killed Walter Scott was insane. Mm-mm. So we pick and choose when we want to do that, and that might go out of the context of even race. It might just go on to actual, you know, people who are, you know, who kill multiple people in these shootings. They want to attach that, you know, to being mentally insane. I haven't quite figured it out yet, and haven't quite mm-hmm. processed that reflection.
And it's also extremely disrespectful, and it's another one of those things, because mental illness within the African American community is such a stigma. So you're talking about someone who could have very easily been dealing with depression or some other mental health issue that had he felt comfortable enough to receive treatment for it, might not have even gone to that extreme. Mm-hmm. But because we're so busy thinking that, well, depression means crazy. No, it doesn't. It just means that you're depressed, okay? And yeah, it's going to manifest itself in different ways, but to just be so dismissive and say that you're crazy, well, who wants to be, even crazy people who really are crazy don't want to be labeled as crazy. So if you know that you're just dealing with the depression because you're dealing with, you know, you're trying to find a way to reconcile your sexuality with your racial identity, and those two things are not peacefully coexisting, well, yeah, that's going to create some mental blues with in you, but that doesn't make you crazy. But you're not going to come out and say, well, look, I need help with X, Y, and Z, because you know you're going to be dismissed. You know that you're not really going to receive any kind of empathy. And yeah, so now it turns into that internalized anger and that internalized hatred. It's going to need an outlet. It's going to have to come out some kind of way, because you can only keep that in you for so long. And then,
well, do kickball, man. Yeah. Boxing. Shoot, I mean, don't be running around killing people.
All of this.
Yeah, but usually when you're talking when it gets to that level, you start thinking on the extreme. You know, either you gotta go or some people have to go. Somebody's going. When it gets to that point, yeah.
All of this in my mind speaks to the larger issue again of Black people creating institutions, not just outlets, not just organizations, but build your own institutions, period, and do it however you got to do it. But the bottom line is, we need fewer ceremonies, we need fewer celebrations, we need fewer demonstrations, less hero worship, and more in the basement planning of a strategy that can actually lead to liberation.
Yeah, I mean, and I always have to ask this question. It might sound a little fantastical, but I'm always wondering, why is it that when brothers want to fight back against the institution and racism and things of that nature, why don't they load up their guns and just, you know, redo their research and just wait for the, you know, the Klansmen to do their, you know, their march in a city near them? Or they go to the neo-Nazi or skinhead compound in Idaho, knock on the door and just open fire.
There's a degree of cowardice in that.
They're very much so.
It's
well, if you're going to kill yourself anyways, might as well just go out guns blazing, kill some real neo-Nazis.
Yeah. Wait for an opportune time. And really, it's one of those things where you have to, you know, fire when fired upon. I think if you're going to carry out action like that, it has to be a situation where they've actually done something where retaliation is necessary.
I just feel like these two white folks, like, again, I'm gonna come back to that. Those were people he had a personal gripe with, and if he was really trying to make a point, then he'd go to like a neo-Nazi compound or a skinhead, you know, fortress, and just knock on the door and open fire, throw Molotov cocktails through the window.
Instead, he used Black Lives Matter as a smokescreen to justify something that he had been wanting to do in the first place.
Right, I didn't even look at that. What you're trying to say, oh yeah. So basically, it puts Black Lives Matter on the hook because he referenced things that Black Lives Matter has supported.
And just weakened that whole movement. He weakened that movement.
So when we talk about, as Black people who have, you know, gained employment with white institutions, and then they experience some form of racism or discrimination, what is the proper way to, you know, address it and respond? I think if we have this conversation to talk about how bad it was that what he did, and we don't talk about what is the most healthy, productive, you know what I'm saying, a reasonable thing to do, then I feel like we haven't done our responsibility today.
Well, mm-hmm. I'll say, you know, had I known him and we had been able to talk about it, I would have said, well, you already have a platform. People know you. You're visible. Start a blog. Create your own website. And you could start out talking about your experiences behind the scenes. You know, okay, this is what I kept running into as a Black and gay male in this very much white male dominated field, and it just got to a point where I got tired of constantly having to prove that I had a right to be there, and then said to myself, I'm just gonna stop doing that and do my own thing. So the other problem was that because he did know how to navigate in those white circles, and that was something that he was used to, that was what he wanted. Because if it was really about empowering himself as a Black man, and he would say, well, I don't really want to deal with, you know, the chain of command and all that anyway. I'll just go do my own thing. So to me, I think the frustration came from the fact that he could not continue in the, you know, white sanctioned, you know, even because mainstream media is still the pinnacle, even though we do have these independent media outlets that are coming up left and right. You know, mainstream media is still looked at as like the goal. So he didn't want to do it in a different way. He didn't want to blaze a trail. He just wanted to be one of those first African American something other. He probably was looking at Don Lemon as some sort of icon and hero, and probably wanted to make it to CNN. And you know, you're not going to do that.
Don Lemon came out, didn't he?
Yeah. And you're not going to get to CNN, I guess the thought is, you're not going to get to CNN coming from a completely independent mindset. And you know, there's a possibility that he was thinking that as well. I mean,
It's interesting that you brought up, you know, that his educational background, his training within these circles, within these Eurocentric white circles. And again, it speaks to the larger issue of education versus training. What are we training our younger generation to do? Are we training them to be able to come back and help build a nation within a nation that can defy these people, outproduce these people, remove the humiliation inflicted by these people? Are we, again, training them to fit in white circles? And then when they meet that crushing disappointment, oh, sorry.
They don't know how to handle it.
Exactly.
Yeah, but you know what?
European coat doesn't fit the African body.
Another perspective, another interesting angle is if we have, if we're suggesting that this brother was totally indoctrinated, right, and assimilated into white institutions and was mad because he wasn't totally accepted, and we talk about training, then on the flip end, what it's actually saying, how it comes out in my calculator, mm-hmm. is that it's actually these white institutions that are training people to be violent, to react the way he reacted.
Absolutely.
You see what I'm saying? It's his education that's causing him to be reactionary, to be violent the way he was. So we cannot, if we're saying he's being trained by white folks, white education, white institutions being trained by them, then we cannot say, oh, part of that training wasn't to be violent, to act out the way you are, you know?
And I completely agree with what you're saying, but I'm sorry. I cannot remove the onus from our people. I cannot remove the onus from the black parent who may be conscious in some sort of way, but is not giving the children a nation mission. One of the most interesting things that Dr. John Henry Clark wrote was that we have to produce, in order to make this thing work, we have to produce that one sacrificial generation and be willing to accept some form of collective discipline in terms of sending them into the schools. If you're going to send them into the schools, train them up first and make them understand what their mission is. You're to come back and help put this together. And we're not asking. This is your cultural, this is your ancestral historical obligation. When we're just sending the kids to the schools and saying, get good grades and you'll make something of yourself and you'll be somebody, but you're not giving them any mission to come help build the African diaspora into some sort of place where they can be mentioned within the conversation of human identity, human history, and have some way to empower themselves, then what are we doing all this for?
But here's the kind of the flaw in that argument. The only reason there isn't that mission being given, the only reason that you know generations after integration have been walking around so handicapped is integration. Integration for a lot of people basically removed that need. So in a world in which you feel that your oppressors are finally accepting you and identifying you as a human being, it doesn't become necessary. You don't understand that there's a larger psychological play at work, because this is definitely chess and not checkers. Mm-hmm. But because you don't see that, you're saying, well, everything's good now. So what's the point of you telling your kid, okay, look, you're getting the white revisionist version of history here, and so when you get home, we're going to teach you this and that so you can be armed. Like, why would there be a need to do that when you feel that you're living, all of a sudden you've been made to believe that you're living in a melting pot? So our parents' generation who were the ones who were present to see desegregated schools didn't even, I'm gonna tell you straight up, no one in my family talked to me about what that was like. to have to go to the only black high school in the city because that's where all of the black kids went. It was for every black child in the city, no matter what part of the city you lived in. No one talked about that. No one talked about, I know I was 9 years old the first time a white dude called me a nigger and I didn't even know what to think. And this was like in the 1980s because nobody ever sat down and had a conversation with me about that. I'll go one better. I was born in 1974. You know what's written on my birth certificate as my race?
Colored.
Colored. Okay. Granted, I was born in Confederate Memorial Hospital.
Oh!
And your baby blanket was a Confederate flag.
I wouldn't be surprised.
My pacifier is probably a rebel flag too.
Oh shoot. My God!
But what I'm getting at is all of this is going on, but there was never a single conversation that anyone in my family had with me about that. So of course, my perspective is, I'm supposed to try to get along with white folks because that's, we're not there anymore. So the racial reality, when I finally came into that understanding, was a really difficult thing for me to wrap my mind around because I had zero preparation. And I had zero preparation because the people whose job it was to educate me on that didn't feel it was necessary. And they didn't feel it was necessary because, well, we're no longer living in that era.
I definitely identify with that. Even though, you know, I came, you know, I'm essentially a Panther kid, even though my father just worked with the Panthers. He wasn't actually a member, but I basically came out the womb fist first. But even despite all of that, you know, and love you, Mom, love you, Dad, but there was still a lack of preparation. There was a lack of proper pass down. When I go from being in all these community schools here in Seattle, Leschi, Madrona, and then all of a sudden get shipped off to Jane Addams in North Seattle, which is Lily White. You know, I mean, that educational integration, man, cut some of us to pieces and scarred us for life.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, putting everything together, I think what we talked about today is the reality is we have to stop disowning the black geek, the black nerd, the black skateboarder, you know what I'm saying? The black intellectual, you know what I'm saying? The black kid that doesn't like to play, you know, basketball, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It might be,
I'm tall, I can't play basketball for shit.
Right.
Okay.
And I think Vester Flanagan, I don't think it's unreasonable to think and to say that he was a person who was disowned by his own community.
Absolutely.
And then, so he sought refuge and he sought to be accepted by the white institutions and by the white community because he was probably viewed as somewhat of a token. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So he understood their, you know, he learned their, you know, their language. He code-switched with them. He went to their institutions. But then when he found out that he didn't belong there either, then he was trapped in his own little world being gay and black. He says, the black community don't want me.
Yeah.
You know, then the white community don't want me. I'm in a community by myself and it's hella lonely. He also mentioned, now this comes from CNN, they might have, you know, King James did, you know what I'm saying? But he also said he was racist against blacks, Asians, and whites. Now, we all know that, like, if you are articulate in the language and the definition of the words, that's not even possible.
Absolutely.
So what he is saying is that he had distrust. He had some angst. He had some bitterness, some anger, some hurt against blacks, Asians, and whites. That's really what he was saying. And he didn't have the power to be a racist. If he had the power to be a racist, he wouldn't have to walk into a news network, kill two white people, and then kill himself. If he had the power to be a racist, then he'd just cut their jobs, you know what I'm saying?
And going about his business.
Going about his business.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things we need to start embracing brothers and sisters in our communities, you know, that are different. And it's kind of funny because all three of us have, you know, endured that, you know, for whatever
reason.
Absolutely.
You know, do you
know
how difficult it is being a black female in the South who, look, I liked to read. That was my thing. You know, so I was coming up with new words. It seemed like I was just pulling them out of thin air because I always had my nose in a book because I enjoyed reading. I enjoyed the process of learning new information and taking that in and using that to enrich me and become a better person, because that was what, that was our ancestral heritage. But my classmates, which was interestingly enough, because I had African-American classmates who were sitting in those college prep classes with me that were ridiculing me for that on the regular. And that is difficult when someone has the audacity to question my racial ethnic identity because I speak proper English and because I know proper terms for specific things. That, yeah, so, and that right there does create that gateway for you to say, to hell with my own people. I'm going to go anywhere where I feel that I'm going to be accepted.
I fit in where I fit in.
And appreciated. And so it's not so much that you're turning, you know, your backs on your own people, that you're disowning your people because you don't like them. It's really because, well, hell, they don't like me.
Mm-hmm.
So where does that leave me? If the people who look like me don't want anything to do with me, I have to, everyone has a tribe. Everyone needs to belong. That is a human thing that we are all hardwired with. So we don't want to walk around feeling as if we are the only ones.
Mm-hmm. Last words. Who's got the last words?
Laura Charles Somerset once said to Lieutenant Francis George Farewell that men like you are invariably caught between two fires and rejected by both sides. It's a difficult place to be in. I empathize with Kameko greatly because I was rejected by black folks. I was rejected by white folks. I like to read and I like to draw. That was my thing. It's unfortunate when we have to completely, you know, disown a brother's actions in the instance that we do here, while at the same time attempting to address the larger issue of institutionalized racism and its emotional and mental effects that it continually, you know, has on black people. But again, it stresses the need. Find a way to create your own institutions.